Welcome to the Embodiment Conference. This channel, Trauma and Social Change, it's absolutely the moment for that, isn't it? I'm Steve Hoskinson. I'm the founder of Organic Intelligence. I've been teaching in this area of trauma, embodiment, and social change for about 25 years. It's an honor, really, for us to be sponsoring this channel where we're going to hear a multiplicity of voice, all unique contributors to our collective understanding of how to move from trauma and support then social change. Our unique voice in organic intelligence has something to do with a koan that I'd like to present to you, which is trauma means unintegrated resource. And that's a koan, and if you'd like and are feeling intrigued about that riddle, then tune in to the post-trauma system development course that we are offering here. The coupon code that'll get you half off on that is ENJOY. Now, enjoy this next presentation, and we'll look forward to another meaningful time as we explore these topics, trauma and social change. Enjoy.
So, without further ado, I introduce you, Nidhi Tiwari. Andrea is a certified EMDR therapist for children, adolescents, and adults. And she will present her session called Intergenerational Trauma and Resilience, Embodying Social Change. That's her personal story turned into the whole narrative. So the floor is yours, Nidhi.
Thank you so much, Kim, for that introduction. Before I get into my presentation, I just wanted to take a moment and thank everyone who has worked so tirelessly to make the Embodiment Conference 2020 possible. I wanted to express my gratitude for being invited to present at this year's conference. And I wanted to specifically thank Mark Walsh, who has worked so hard to be able to put this together, Kim and Julie, who have helped me along with the Trauma and Social Change channel, and for all of the volunteers that have worked tirelessly to be able to make this event a success. Thank you all so, so much. As Kim mentioned, my presentation today is called Intergenerational Trauma and Resilience, Embodying Social Change. And my name is Nidhi Tiwari. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and therapist located in Richmond, Virginia, in the United States of America. Before I get into my presentation, just a couple of things that I wanted to mention on the front end. One is that this presentation is going to have an interactive component to it. So I am going to go ahead and appreciate the fact that you're going to actively participate in this, and that's how you're going to get the most out of this presentation. And that, of course, this presentation doesn't constitute as therapy. It doesn't replace therapy. And while it's not a particularly heavy topic that I'm touching on today, that if there is anything that's uncomfortable that comes up for you along the way, to please seek out some support from a licensed mental health professional in your locality. And then in any trauma presentation that I give, I always like to encourage you to please take good care of yourself. Take breaks as needed. If you feel triggered, grab a glass of water, take some deep breaths, and then rejoin when you feel ready to do so. So we're going to cover three objectives in this presentation. I think I would be remiss to not cover the foundational knowledge that is so key, the frameworks that are so important in viewing trauma and resilience. This is an international conference, so we have people from all over the world participating. And that also means that we have people from all different professions participating. And so I think it's really important for us to cover the basics of how to view trauma and resilience and what the physiological and psychological impact of them are. Second, we're going to be looking at addressing the intergenerational nature of trauma and resilience. How is trauma and resilience passed down from each generation to each generation? And then lastly, we're going to be connecting to our own stories. I'll be sharing my stories of intergenerational trauma and resilience, and then I'll be providing an EMDR exercise for you then to be able to connect to your own experiences in your life. So a little bit about me before we jump into all of this. As Kim mentioned, my name is Nidhi Tiwari, and I'm an EMDRIA certified EMDR therapist. I'm also a consultant in training, and I own my own private practice in Richmond, Virginia. It's been such a joy being able to own my own practice. I love being an entrepreneur. I love working with the clients that I see, and I really enjoy being able to provide consultation to other EMDR therapists all across the country. I specialize in treating children, adolescents, and adults who are coping with trauma, and I have a special interest in intergenerational trauma and resilience. That is typically what is underlying complex PTSD, and I think it's really important to be looking at how past generations influence our present-day life experience. And for this presentation, I think it's important to note that I am bicultural and I'm a first-generation Indian American. So you'll see later on in the presentation why that's relevant, but my parents immigrated here and I was born here in the United States. So as we look at trauma, we really want to broaden the lens of trauma. When we typically think about trauma, we're thinking about the really big stuff, right? We're thinking about natural disasters. We're thinking about sexual assault. We're talking about war and combat. And those are absolutely traumatic experiences, but we also want to broaden the lens to a vast spectrum of experience. We want to look at trauma as anything that is too fast, too soon, or too much for the nervous system to fully process. And that's taken from one of the amazing greats that are presenting at this year's conference, Peter Levine. And we want to be looking at how trauma is defined by the experiencer. So what I mean by that is, if I happen to twist my ankle, for example, it might be painful, of course. It may create a situation where I have to, you know, not walk on it, not be super active for a couple of days. But for me, it may not be considered a tremendously traumatic experience. Uncomfortable, sure, but not traumatic. For an individual who has a chronic pain condition, however, twisting their ankle could be debilitating. It could mean that they're bedridden for weeks on end. It could create other physiological challenges. And so this is just an example of how trauma can be defined by the experiencer, that we really want to be careful with this idea of big T versus little t traumas, and instead to look at how is the individual experiencing that challenge. And that memories are encoded in our brains and bodies. So that means that we have neural networks that end up being frozen with the information from that traumatic experience. Typically, that includes a negative image, something that's disturbing, that kind of captures that moment of the trauma. There's usually a negative belief about ourselves. Maybe it's my fault, that I'm not good enough, I should have done more. So those are the types of negative beliefs that we tend to develop surrounding a trauma. There are negative emotions. We may feel fear or anxiety as we think back or experience a trauma. And then, of course, all of those experiences are embodied within us. So we have a somatic component of it too. Your chest might become tight as you think about a traumatic experience or while you're in the moment of trauma. Maybe your gut turns and feels really uncomfortable. So looking at all the different layers and that all of this memory is encoded with this information. And that as a result of trauma, physiological changes occur. So that means that our brain releases cortisol, which is a hormone, a stress hormone, and it floods our system with cortisol. That then increases our heart rate. We might notice our blood pressure goes up. Our muscles become very tense and rigid. That even our gut changes. There's a lot of research now around how gut bacteria is tied to our mood and our mental health. So we notice that we may have digestion issues or just the simple flora within our gut changes. And then, of course, sleep disturbances come into play as well. So here's a diagram that I've put together about the way that the brain changes before and after trauma. So the first line here shows you the before, and we're looking at three different parts of the brain, the amygdala, prefrontal cortex, and hippocampus. And then in the second line, you can see the after. So this is after trauma happens. How are these three parts of the brain impacted? So our amygdala is our brain's threat response system. Typically, it goes off only when danger is actively present. You can kind of think of it like a home alarm system almost. The alarm system typically isn't going to go off unless there's an intruder at the door or somebody trying to break in through the window. Then the alarm sounds off, understandably so. And then we jump into action. That might be mobilization, or we might try and hide from the intruder. So that's going to be immobilization, right? Or we might shut down. But the amygdala usually only responds when there's active danger present. The prefrontal cortex is the brain's decision-making center. So it's responsible for complex thinking. It's responsible for our rational thinking, so the ability to problem solve. And then it's also responsible for appropriate behavior, so determining, is my reaction appropriate or inappropriate given the circumstances? And then the hippocampus is our brain's memory storage system. You can think of it almost like a file cabinet where it stores away all these different memories. And it transfers information into memories as well. So this is the normal functioning of a brain. Now, what happens after a trauma occurs? Well, with the amygdala, remembering that it's our alarm system of the brain, all of a sudden now, even though active threat is not present, just the memories and thoughts of the trauma evoke that same type of response. And we might go into mobilization or immobilization, which I'll cover in my next slide. And so here we are looking at flashbacks, nightmares, things like that, that are bringing up that same somatic experience and spurring us into action or inaction. Then we have the prefrontal cortex, remembering that that's our decision-making and decision-making center, and that the functionality of our prefrontal cortex is diminished after a trauma occurs. So that means that appropriate reactions become difficult to gauge, and we may have a lot of challenges being able to really logically think something through, especially in those moments of being triggered. So it might feel like swirling thoughts, like it's really hard to be able to ground yourself and, you know, determine up from down. And then our hippocampus, which is our brain's filing system, our memory filing system, becomes compromised. It starts to store memories incorrectly. And so memories become difficult to access. That's pretty common with trauma survivors, actually, where there may not be a concrete memory of the experience itself. And those memories carry a very intense emotional charge. So just like I'd mentioned earlier, those negative body sensations, negative beliefs about ourselves, negative emotions, all of that gets attached now to just the memory of this traumatic experience. So another amazing person who's presenting in this conference this year is Stephen Porges, and he's the one who's created polyvagal theory, and Deb Dana has collaborated with him on this as well. And so polyvagal theory is a little bit of a different theoretical framework with which to look at our trauma responses. So you'll see here I have mobilization, immobilization, which is also considered dorsal vagal shutdown, and then ventral vagal responses. So when we look at mobilization, we're looking at these feelings of uneasiness, this almost keyed up feeling that we need to jump into action, difficulty sitting still, a lot of high energy, anxiety, it would be the presentation that we would typically think of. So let's take an example. Here in the United States, we have the Rocky Mountains, which is a huge mountain range, really beautiful. And there's lots of trails that you can walk on. But if you walk those trails, you'll see that there are signs that indicate to you, beware of the bears, lots of black bears that exist, and that you're not supposed to feed the bears, that you want to keep your distance from the bears. And so if we were in a mobilization response, let's say that, you know, we're walking on this trail and then all of a sudden a bear crosses our path and is becoming aggressive towards us. If we were in mobilization, well, we might do one of two things. If it's safe to run away, we're going to try and book it. We're going to try and run as quickly and as far away as possible from that bear because the bear is the threat. Or we might try and fight the bear. So if you have a knife on you, you might try and knife the bear. You may try and debilitate the bear. Or if you don't have a weapon on you, you may try to become loud and scary to really ward off the bear. Go, rah, make lots of noise, right? Make ourselves bigger and stronger than the bear. And then the bear may feel threatened and may run away. So that's an example of how a mobilization response may come into play. Now, looking at that same scenario of the bear, we can look at immobilization or dorsal vagal shutdown. So that's going to look like feelings of being completely out of control, helplessness, low or no energy. So almost this depressed presentation. And on a little bit more on further along on the spectrum, we may be going into disconnection and disassociation. So this idea that we're disconnecting from the emotional experience, the somatic experience, almost feel as though we're an observer of it. So if the bear crosses our path and we go into immobilization, we may try and make ourselves as small as possible, right? We may try and hide away wherever we can. We may, you know, try and be silent, freeze a little bit. So those are potential immobilization responses. And so what do we do now that we know what these responses are after trauma occurs? How do we mitigate that? Well, we engage the ventral vagal system. So this entails connection, safety, calm, peace, that we recognize, okay, this is an event that occurred then, and now I have supports to be able to process the experience. Now I'm able to reflect on it and develop an internal sense of safety once again. These are the moments that we're able to regulate our emotions, that we're able to, you know, bring down this highly activated state, or if we're immobilized, bring in some energy there. So how does this relate to intergenerational trauma and resilience? Well, there are cycles of trauma and resilience that can be passed down through modeling and through culture. So what I mean by that is that we tend to observe from our parents, society at large, what's appropriate and what's inappropriate behavior. If a child grows up in a household where a parent becomes loud and aggressive in order to get their needs met, they may yell, scream, talk over people. Well, that's being modeled for this child. So not always, but sometimes that child may go to school. And then if another student takes their toy all of a sudden, well, guess how that kid's going to respond? It's been modeled to them that we get louder and more aggressive as a way to be able to ensure that our needs are met. So that kid may scream, that kid may punch or hit, that kid may, you know, talk over the other child. So that's an example of how these behaviors can be modeled for us. And then, of course, culturally, there's norms that occur in each culture. And so we don't want to know what we don't know. An example would be that I'm Indian, right? I'm an Indian American. So I have the perspective of both cultures. And in India, arranged marriage is a very normal thing. It's actually, you know, pretty traditional, although that's changing nowadays, but for the most part, it's widely accepted. And in fact, it's encouraged, it's expected that your parents have a hand in choosing your partner and that the families marry one another. That's kind of the idea behind it. But if I didn't have the context of being Indian, and if I was just purely American, the idea of an arranged marriage may feel extremely odd to me, very foreign. In fact, some people may even look at it as disempowering, that, oh my gosh, I don't have a choice as to who my partner may or may not be. And so you can see here how the cultural context frames a lot of our experience. And so we want to be looking at it from that perspective, that culture as well as our upbringing inform what our present day experiences are, and that we don't know what we don't know. And then epigenetics play a role and can influence our brain and body biology as well. And when we talk about epigenetics, we're talking about the way that the environmental factors around us influence our brain and biological functioning and how that's passed down through each generation. So there's been a multitude of research done on this very topic, but there's two that I'm going to hit on today specifically. One is a series of research studies done by Dr. Rachel Yehuda et al. And she did three different studies here, three different generations, one in 1998, one in 2016, and then one in 2020. And she did research on Holocaust survivors. So the 1998 study was done on the actual survivors of the Holocaust. And then she followed up with their offspring and then, you know, the grandchildren as well. And what she found was that there was a genetic change that occurred within each generation. The methylation, which is a process that occurs within our genetic makeup, was changed in our DNA. So it really speaks to the idea that on a biological level here, our experiences, our environmental factors do influence us physiologically. And then there was another study done by Dr. Lumi, and this is in 2008. And this was also done with Holocaust survivors, Dutch Holocaust survivors, who experienced famine. And what they found is that there were genetic shifts that happened there as well. The way that the body was storing and processing food was different now, and that other health issues arose. So triglyceride levels went up. That those who were in utero during the famine actually had a higher rate of premature death. And so now, once again, we're looking here at they experienced something that was a social change, and it affected their genetic makeup, their physiological makeup. And this is kind of a little bit of a trip, something that is so interesting to look at, that all of our mother's eggs were produced when she was in utero in her mother. So just think about that for a moment, that our mother's eggs were produced when she was in our grandmother's uterus. So look at that, that genetic makeup from our grandmother is very directly tied to the genetic makeup of our mothers. And then that's passed on in turn to us. So we're seeing once again how this is happening on a biological level. And then there's intergenerational social change. So each generation that came before us in some capacity experienced social change. It may not look the same as in our generation, but nonetheless, they experienced a pretty tremendous amount of social change. And that we are the products of their survival and their social change experiences. That resilience is embodied within us. And that accessing these stories is critical in connecting to our past so that we can then implement change in the future. We can utilize these embodied experiences for activism, for social justice, for fighting against prejudice, that we can access that inner knowledge and utilize it going forward in our own lives in the present day. All right, so this is a really exciting aspect of my presentation. Typically when I do presentations, it's for the therapist crowd. So it's all about professional development, teaching skills, giving a lot of the heady stuff, therapeutic interventions, things like that. And this is such a unique opportunity for me to share my own intergenerational experiences with both trauma and resilience. One of my amazing mentors, she's a phenomenal EMDR expert, Ana Gomez, has always taught me that our brains and our bodies are storytellers, that parts of us hold these stories within us. And so today I'm really looking forward to sharing these stories with you. If you look here at these pictures, I have four pictures, and these are three different generations that we have here in these pictures. The picture on the upper left-hand corner, you can see two individuals there that are my great-grandfather and my grandfather. My great-grandfather is the one who's sitting down. He's holding my uncle. And then my grandfather is to the right of him, and he's holding my mother. And so how cool is it, right, that I get to have this image? I never got to meet either of them. They both passed away before I was born. But I get to see this picture here. And I'll be sharing some of my great-grandfather's experiences with social justice and activism. And then to the right of that picture is my nani, my grandmother, who is the daughter of my great-grandfather, who's in the picture of the left, in the left. And my nani, I did get to meet. She was a wonderful woman. I got to spend a lot of time with her when she came here to the United States for a bit. And then when she went back to India, I went there multiple times to visit with her and just really loved her so tremendously. She's passed away now, but I still carry within me her stories as well. And she also engaged in social justice and activism. And then in that bottom left-hand corner, you can see my sister on the left, me in the middle, and then my mother on the right. So there it is, the next generation of women in our family. And my mom has her own experiences and stories of trauma and resilience immigrating here to the United States. The picture to the bottom right, I'll go over and I'll touch on in just a minute. So what are these stories? Well, for my great-grandfather, he grew up in 1947 India. He was an adult during that time. And for those of you who may not be super familiar with Indian history, 1947 was partition. This was the period of decolonization in India. And India was split up based off of religious affiliation. This caused a tremendous amount of unrest. So much pain on all sides there. And it was a really difficult experience for everyone who called themselves Indians. And so my great grandfather grew up in the time of Mahatma Gandhi, who I think we're all pretty much familiar with. And Mahatma Gandhi was a big proponent of being able to spin your own materials, your own textiles. He had his own ability to be able to create textiles. There's some images of that. And my great-grandfather used to love wearing ornate clothing. He loved embellished and embroidered clothing. And, he was quite a dapper man from what I've heard. And so, you know, he worked for the government and really enjoyed being able to show his personality through his clothes. But when Mahatma Gandhi was a leader in India, he promoted the Swadeshi movement, which was all about being able to utilize textiles that were made by hand by each individual person. And that, you know, we were going to be boycotting the clothing that came from other places or that utilized, you know, those higher quality goods that, you know, weren't handmade here. And so part of the Swadeshi movement was he organized within his community, and there's pictures of this somewhere. I couldn't get my hands on them. Wish I could, but there's a picture of this where he organized within his community, everyone coming together and taking their ornate embroidered clothing and burning it as a form of protest, a way of saying, we're no longer going to support this. And that instead, we're going to create our own garments. And as you can see in that picture, he's wearing a very simple garment. And that was part of his protest as well. He changed his entire style as a way to be able to engage in social justice during this time of partition. And so I just think that it's such an amazing story that he was able to rally his community together and help them to be able to burn these clothes as a way of saying, no longer are we gonna accept this. Okay, so now let's move to that next generation. My grandmother, my Nani. Well, my grandmother also grew up during partition, but she was a teenager during that time. But she was an adult during 1986, which was the Indira Gandhi assassination. And Indira Gandhi was a renowned, very well-liked politician in India. And her assassination created waves of unrest throughout the country. And what ended up happening is that groups were targeted. And so her neighbors were part of a group that was going to be targeted. And my grandmother was willing to be able to risk her life and her family's life to protect her neighbors. She told them that if at any point you feel unsafe, if at any point you feel as though you may be targeted by anyone, please come to my home. I will feed you. I will clothe you. I will hide you away to ensure that you and your family and your loved ones are safe. So look at that. That's another example of social justice occurring. And this is just within her community, once again, that she recognized that this is not okay. It's not okay to target any single group, that her neighbors are wonderful human beings, that their children are innocent, that they're all innocent here, and that she wanted to do whatever she could in her power to protect them. So that's that next generation there. And now let's look at my mother. So my mother was pregnant with me when she immigrated here to the United States. And in India, we have intergenerational houses, right? So we got the grandparents living there. We have the parents, we have the cousins, the uncles, the nieces, the nephews, everyone lives together. And there's a community raising of children. And so my sister, who's 7 years older than I am, got to grow up with this environment where the entire community came together to raise her. And that also means that my mom and my dad had lots of support in being able to raise my sister. And so when my mother immigrated here to the United States, she came here just with my dad and my sister. So she left behind all of her social supports and she came here with $500. Now, even back then, $500 was not enough money to get an apartment or to really do anything. It's barely enough money to really buy yourself groceries for a couple of months, right? Food is much more expensive than just $500 for 2 months worth, right? So she came here with very little and she grew up in India, you know, with a pretty well-to-do family, lots of supports there. So you can imagine how traumatic that was for her, that it was really difficult, you know, having a 7-year-old child, you know, who's in this really young developmental phase. And then on top of that, you're pregnant with your second born, your second child here. And so when she came here to the United States, she also, you know, in India was highly educated. My mom has 2 master's degrees. She has a master's in economics and a master's in law. And she was actually a teacher at a public school, which is, you know, they call it public school, but it's really a private school in India, and was a pretty well-known teacher locally. And so she, you know, she had a lot of education under her belt. But when she came here to the United States, none of those degrees were honored. Not a one of them. And she had to take 2 years to raise me because I'm an infant, right? I was just born, you know, a couple months after they came here to the United States. So she's trying to, you know, be there for my formative years. And when she applied for jobs, they told her that none of these degrees are valid. And they questioned, why did you take these 2 years off? So my mom could have given up at that point and said, okay, I'll just, you know, I don't know what else to do now. I mean, I've worked so hard my whole life to get the status and now it's invalid here. So, okay, I guess that's just the way that it's going to be. That'll be my narrative. No, my mom did not accept that. What did my mom do? She got a job at a grocery store as a cashier. A woman with 2 master's degrees was working as a cashier at a grocery store. But that's what she felt she had to do in order to get her foot in the door. And from there, she built her career. She didn't know anything about finances and being able to be a financial planner, the mortgaging industry. And she taught herself and learned through just, you know, experience, put herself out there. And she worked her way up to become a vice president in Bank of America, which is one of the biggest banks here in the United States. So it's a true American dream story, a true comeuppance. And it was all because she had experienced this trauma of coming here and having none of her degrees validated, having very little to her name, but also more importantly, that resilient story of not accepting that, saying that's not going to be my life. I want to provide more, not only for myself, but for my children. And she and my dad worked so hard to be able to give us everything that we have here in the United States. So there's that next generation. Now, how does this affect me today, right? Because I'm the next generation here. So I embody all of these experiences within me. My mom encountered prejudice. We had a lot of help and support here in the United States, but we also encountered prejudice. And if you look at that bottom right picture there, you'll see a vehicle. That's our Concorde from the early 90s, and it's spray painted. My aunt helped us to be able to make phone calls at various apartment complexes. And, you know, she just checked in to see what apartments are available. And my aunt had immigrated here, you know, in the 70s. So she doesn't really have much of an accent. And when she spoke on the phone, all of the apartment complex owners said, yeah, absolutely. There's 5 or 6 apartments available. We'd love to show them to you. Why don't we schedule an appointment for the next hour or so? You come in, we'll take a look at it and see if it's a good fit. And so my mom and dad would show up. My dad's very Indian looking, has a little bit of an accent. And my mom doesn't have an accent because she attended a British school, but she does look Indian. And when they showed up to view these apartments, all of a sudden, within 30 minutes, 45 minutes, those apartments were all gone. Now, it doesn't take a genius to realize that that's a lie. That honestly, they were being discriminated against based off of their skin color. And so how does the social justice piece play into this? Well, you know, they got the community together. They contacted HUD, which is in the United States, it's a government agency for housing and development. And there are laws against discrimination based off of age, gender, race, et cetera. And they said, they basically contacted HUD and said, this is not right. This is not fair that you're discriminating against us just based off of our racial background. And HUD then held that apartment complex owner accountable. Never again did they discriminate against people based off of their skin color. They had a microscope on them now. So they were able to spur all of this into social change, even here in the United States, as difficult as that was. So I learned many lessons from all of these generations in my family. I learned from my mom that education is so critical, that she had to work so hard to be able to become highly educated, and that didn't even count in this country. And so for me, she instilled that you have to be able to be academically driven, that you have to see the value in academic success, because that provides you with the launch pad to be able to achieve all of your dreams. She also taught me that you never give up. There were many points along the way that she could have said, I'm going to throw in the towel. I don't want to do this any longer. And she didn't. And I had that modeled for me time and time again, that as a woman in this country, as an immigrant in this country, that your dreams are attainable if you just work towards them. And I embody all of this in now my practice as a therapist. By nature, helping people to heal from trauma is social justice. Trauma is social injustice. It's something really terrible occurring to somebody that they never wanted to have happen in their lives. And being able to walk alongside my clients and helping them to heal from their trauma is such a tremendous experience, humbling experience for me, but I recognize it as radical social change, that I'm helping people to break intergenerational cycles. I also am very anti-racist, and I utilize those messages with my EMDR consultees. I utilize that with my supervisees through various universities that are in the Masters of Social Work program. And I really teach them that we need to be actively anti-racist. That means having difficult conversations. That means having to put ourselves out there and doing things despite the fact that there's discomfort. And so I embody these messages within me somatically. I notice it in the pride in my shoulders as I talk about all of my experiences. I notice it in my gut, that my gut doesn't feel in knots. Instead, I feel courageous inside. And so these are the ways that I've taken my intergenerational messages and utilized them in my day-to-day life. And so now we're going to move into this activity. Just a friendly reminder of this disclaimer that this exercise may pull on some heavy stuff for you. And if it does, that's okay. If it's uncomfortable, just notice it. And please seek support from a licensed professional, licensed mental health professional locally. And once again, if you need to take a break, take a breather, please feel free to do so. So before we get into connecting with your stories, I want to fully acknowledge the fact that not everybody has this experience where it's just laid out so cleanly, great-grandfather, grandmother, mother, and oh, here's the connection and ties between the three of them. Some people may not know the backgrounds of their intergenerational experiences, and that's absolutely okay. I want to include you and encourage you to participate as well. That instead, notice the felt sense within you, that you too have an intuitive sense as to what these messages are. One of my good friends, Michelle, she doesn't really know a whole lot about her, you know, past generational experiences. She doesn't know about her great-grandparents or her grandparents. They all passed away before she was born. But yet, within her, she has an innate draw towards nature and towards music. She can't point out exactly where it comes from, but that's how we know it's a felt sense. Somewhere in her generational line and lineage, someone embraced those two aspects of life, nature and music. And so she utilizes those for social change through providing ecotherapy to trauma survivors. And that's how she incorporates nature. And she utilizes music as a way to collaborate with other mental health professionals. She uses music as a healing modality for us trauma survivors as well. So you too can access these messages, even if you don't have a direct connection and a conscious awareness of these intergenerational stories. I'm going to encourage you to observe your inner experience. So just notice what's coming up for you. And for some of us, our past generations, were individuals that struggled quite a bit. We may have had ancestors that were abusive. We may have had people that were hurting other people in our past lineage. And so I just want you to reflect, if that's the case, are you now the first one in your entire lineage who's breaking the intergenerational cycle? And to connect with the fact that that is such a courageous and resilient experience to be able to do that. All right, so how do we now look at social change themes through the generations? So once again, because I was born in the United States and all of my schooling and education was done here in the States, my perspective and my examples are going to come from US history. History around the world is going to look very different than this. So I'm just going to encourage you to think about the themes from each generation that came before you and to utilize that as an opportunity to connect with those messages. So if your parents or grandparents grew up in a World War II or post-World War II generation, then they may have grown up wanting to establish security and stability for your families. World War II destabilized the entire world, but especially here in the United States. There was a lot of scarcity and hardship during that time. And so it's no wonder that people wanted to establish a firm sense of stability for their family there going forward. If your parents grew up in the 60s and 70s, here in the United States, we call it the free love era. Well, they may have advocated for racial desegregation, which occurred in the 60s here in the United States, or they may have been a part of the feminist movement. And so that might mean that they attended the protests for racial desegregation, to be able to ensure that schooling was an equal opportunity for everyone, and that we had everyone together in the same school, most importantly. And that, you know, women have a right to be able to get a job, get a credit card without their husband signing off on it, be able to take out a loan without their husband signing off on it, drive, all of those things. That came with the feminist movement here in the United States. So if we looked at the history books, and if we looked at each country represented, even if we looked at the exact same experience, a different narrative would be told about those global events. And this, of course, can influence our social change themes. So I'll take the example of World War II that I mentioned earlier. The way that World War II was experienced here in the United States is going to be vastly different than the way that World War II was experienced in Europe. And that's going to be a tremendously different experience than the way that World War II was experienced in Asia. So just looking at, this is the same war that we all went through across the globe, but that the experience was so different depending on the country that you grew up in. So I just want you to honor that experience and to check in and notice those themes based off of the country that you're participating from. So just very briefly, this is not an EMDR presentation. I give a lot of those, but this isn't one of them. So I just want to briefly talk about what EMDR is. It stands for eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing. And it's an integrative therapeutic approach, which means it incorporates a lot of different modalities. And what we're doing is we're essentially connecting neural networks. We're making new neural connections here. We're connecting resilient neural networks that have adaptive information. And we're connecting them with the trauma frozen networks, right, that are holding all of that traumatic information. We're bringing in adaptive information through the processing work. All right, so that's kind of the basis of EMDR. And if you want to learn more, I have my email address and multiple ways to reach out to me. So feel free to reach out. And I also have some resources for the EMDRIA, which is EMDRIA website, which is the EMDR International Association website. So you can find that on my last page of my presentation. So I want to take a moment and transition now to this activity. I just want to take a second and ground ourselves. And we're going to do that by taking 3 mindful breaths. The technique that I utilize is a 4-4-6 breathing technique. You're going to breathe in through your nose for 4 seconds, hold in the breath for 4 seconds, and then exhale through your mouth for 6 seconds. I'm going to do it alongside you so you can follow along. Hold. Hold. Hold it. Just take a moment and notice what shifted somatically for you. Just observe if your heart rate slowed down a bit, if the muscle tension kind of reduced for a moment there. Maybe your lungs got a lot more oxygen than they have in the last little bit. So just noticing that somatic shift that comes when we ground ourselves and take these mindful breaths. And as a part of this exercise, it's important to learn the butterfly hug. So I'm going to demonstrate this for you now. What you're going to do is you're going to take your 2 hands, you're going to cross them over, and you can link your thumbs just like this, or you can lay them flat like this, whatever works the best. And what you're going to do is you're going to lay your fingertips right up by your collarbone. And so what you'll hear me do is I'll count off 1, 2, and you'll hear me tap alongside 1, 2. So that way you get the cadence of it. And I'm just going to ask you to follow along as I say the 1, 2, knowing it's a left-right motion. So go ahead and keep that butterfly hug ready to go. I'm just going to ask you all to take a moment and invite you to pick an image that represents these resilience experiences within you, that are embodied within you. Think back to the stories that your grandparents and parents, aunts and uncles have told you. Moments of courage and strength that they demonstrated. Or if you want to pull on your felt sense, Think about those moments. Connect with your intuitive self. Just notice those moments of strength and courage within you. A time where you might have stood up and said something when it felt uncomfortable to do so. And as you notice that image, I'm just going to ask you to just pay attention to those positive emotions that come up that are associated with that image. Perhaps you feel courageous. Maybe there's a feeling of strength. Maybe there's a motivational aspect to this. So just observing what emotional experience is happening within you. And then when you're ready, we're going to notice what's loosening up in your body. So if your shoulders were up here, maybe your shoulders drop down a bit. If your gut was kind of in knots, maybe that's relaxed. If your chest was tight, maybe it's easier to breathe right now. So just noticing anywhere that there's a reduction of tension occurring. And so I'm going to ask you to notice those three things together. Just focus on that image of resilience. Notice those positive emotions that come up for you as you think about that image. And observe that lessening of tension, wherever that might be in your body. And when you have those three things together, we're going to do some taps on it. One, two. One, two. One, two. One, two. One, two. One, two. One. So now we're going to add one more thing to this. We're just going to think of a word that you could say to yourself, a cue word that would take you right back to this image with all of the positive emotions and positive bodies and sensations that are attached to this resilience experience. It could be a word as simple as survivor. Maybe it's resilience. Maybe it's peace, strength, whatever it is. Just think of what that word might be that can take you right back to this embodied experience. And once you have that word, I'm going to ask you to think about that image again of this moment of resilience. We're going to notice those positive emotions that come up for you. Observe that lessening of tension in your body. And over top in your mind, you're just going to repeat whatever that cue word was that you came up with. We're going to do some taps as you notice all those things together. Okay. One. Two. One. One, two, one, two, one, two, one, two, one, two. All right. So now the last part of this exercise, we don't have to do any more butterfly hug taps with this. But I'm just going to ask you to see if we can say that cue word back to yourself. And let's see if we can bring up that positive image of resilience alongside those positive emotions and those positive body sensations. Let's just practice that a few times in your mind, just repeating that cue word and seeing, can we bring back up all of that experience once again? So just take a moment and practice that. All right, and now you have a body reference. Now you have a place and a way to be able to access these messages and these stories within you. It's tied to whatever positive body sensation you identified with this exercise. And for some people, they really enjoy doing the butterfly hug alongside it. So just as long as you're doing very slow taps, it can be a very soothing, comforting experience. So now you can access this information and utilize it for your own social justice movement, your own change and activism in your community or in your family or whatever, wherever you can. And so I want to end this presentation by allowing you and inviting you the opportunity to check in on yourself. How did this activity feel for you in your mind and body now that you've completed this exercise? Was there anything uncomfortable that came up for you? Perhaps there was feelings of shame or guilt for being the first cycle breaker. So just noticing that. How can you now take this intergenerational knowledge and apply it to making social change happen in your life? And asking yourself, what is your sphere of influence? So for me, my sphere of influence is my clients. It's my colleagues. It's the opportunity to be able to present here today that this is a social justice moment for me. This is an activism moment for me, being able to share these experiences with you. And so think about, what is my sphere of influence? Is it my family? Is it my friends? Is it my community? Maybe it's, you know, you maybe have a platform where you can reach your whole country. Or maybe it's something like this, where it's a conference that goes all around the world. But just observing the fact that you too have a sphere of influence where you can utilize these messages to spur social change. All right, well, so we're at the end here. I want to thank each and every one of you for being present here for my talk. Here are four different ways to reach me. At the top is my email. You can also find my website, my Instagram, and my Facebook. Lots of ways to get in contact with me. And then all of the resources and research that I cited is here in my references as well. So you can take a look at it. I cited the greats, Peter Levine, Peter Levine and Stephen Porges, and all of these amazing researchers that were able to contribute to the field, and many of which are participating in this conference today. So I want to thank you all once again for participating and for being present here with me. And I wish you all the best of luck. Thank you all so much.
Alrighty. Welcome back, everyone. I really hope you got so much value out of Nidhi's presentation. I see so much love and support for you in the chat, especially. Nidhi, I am going to ask you one final question. Before I do that, is there anything you would like to say before we get into some housekeeping?
I just wanted to thank each and every one of you for participating today. It means so much to me to have you join. And if you didn't get the opportunity to share this with others, that there's a free 48-hour replay period. So to just go ahead and share it with anybody that you can who could benefit from these messages today.
Fantastic. Yeah, that's an amazing point. This will be free for 48 hours. You can also watch it over on our Facebook page for the Trauma and Social Change Group, which is a fabulous resource as well. Please also feel free to join the Embodiment Conference Facebook group as a way to connect. And right after this presentation, we do have a coffee break coming up. Just like Nidhi was saying, it's going to be free for 48 hours. Just a heads up for folks who are thinking about buying the library, maybe making a purchase. It is going up after the end of this conference. So please, if you're thinking that you'd like to rewatch these sessions, consider either buying the full Trauma and Social Change channel or buying the library as a whole. There's so much that's going on throughout this conference, whether you're looking and wanting to go back to Stephen Porges' session or Dr. Peter Levine. So many incredible presenters that a lot of them are cited in your work as well. So folks, if you are looking what's coming up next on this channel, we do have some fabulous things as we end our conference. Next up is Neurodiversity with Suzanne Lamont. So please feel free to come and join us for that session too. Nidhi, I'm gonna ask you one final question, and that is, what is your top tip for embodiment?
My top tip is that embodied within each of us are the stories of resilience from all generations past. And that if you can connect with your own experiences of resilience somatically and emotionally, you can draw upon them to enact social change.
Fabulous. Thank you so much. And thank you for an insightful presentation and sharing all of your experience with us both personally and professionally. We really appreciate you.
Thank you so much for having me again, and I really appreciate you as well.
Awesome. All right, everyone, have an amazing night or morning, depending where you are in the world. We hope to see you back soon on the Trauma and Social Change channel. Bye, everyone.